talk to me in the first instance. That's not privileged. That's never been privileged. And that wouldn't be privileged by this bill. But the basic idea that you can talk to your attorney and get advice from your attorney is a fundamental part of the whole system. And the only question here is how should that be applied to corporations, and in effect whether corporations are deserving of less privilege, less protection, than we grant individuals. And I don't think they are. And this is not just a problem for Tektronix. This is a problem for every corporation. A small corporation or a partnership can have employees. Those employees need not be a part of the control group. In fact, commonly will not be a part of the control group. And if they're not a part of the control group, the small corporation or the partnership has the same exact problem that we're talking about here. All that this bill would do is make the Oregon rule, bring the Oregon bill, the Oregon law, in line with the federal law. Now, I haven't noticed any great tendency of people to shy away from federal litigation or any great complaint from the plaintiff's bar that they can't get the discovery that they want in federal litigation because of the federal attorney-client privilege rule. That's not the way it goes. In fact, there are certain federal statutes, such as employment discrimination, such as sex discrimination, which are preferred remedies. And they're preferred remedies, notwithstanding the fact that there may be some bits of information or pieces of information that people can't get because of privilege, which is to say the actual privileged communications themselves. But the underlying facts, the underlying circumstances, are all capable of discovery. What this bill seeks to make it tougher to do, in line with existing federal law, is to make it tougher for someone to try their case on wits borrowed from their adversary, as the phrase is put. You got to go out and you got to explore the facts on your own if you want to be a plaintiff. You can't just roll up and say, all right, defendant, tell me what you told your lawyer and what your lawyer told you, and then I'll just go home. You have to go out and do your own discovery and learn your own facts, and that's the way it works. I understand that one of the arguments made against this bill is that it would put a cloak of silence over the activities of defendants. If that's true, I've been wasting a lot of my clients' time and money over the last 11 years. We respond to discovery. We respond to discovery extensively. We respond to discovery on the facts. What we don't want to respond to, we don't have to respond to under federal law, and to the extent of the control group test under state law now, is to communications between attorney and client. And what I think, and what I think the policy of the state should be, is to put corporations, in effect, on an even footing with individuals in that regard. A corporation may act through its officers. It may also act through people below the officership level. And I suppose if the senator believes that in the mom-and-pop grocery store case that communication wouldn't be protected with my individual owner, then presumably there's no protection under the existing law in any case, so the hypothetical falls for a different reason. But we have to allow people to be able to consult their attorneys. Otherwise, as Mr. Lewis said, the process that attorneys go through commonly with their clients, soliciting information from their clients and giving advice to their clients, will be adversely affected. And the best lawsuit is one not brought. The best resolution of a legal problem is one that gets worked out before a case is ever filed. And anything that impedes the flow of information back and forth hurts that. Could attorneys use this to become involved in, let's say, knowingly keeping defective products on the market? Not very likely. There is a crime or fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege, which applied before Oregon adopted this rule and will continue to apply. An attorney who was involved in wrongdoing is not going to have a privilege for that. Could a corporation, a willful corporation, use this provision to route all standard business communications through their attorneys and thereby shield everything from discovery? The answer, again, is no, because under existing law and otherwise, it is only a communication for purposes of giving legal advice, which is protected. And if you try to run through corporate counsel non-legal advice issues, day-to-day business matters, you wouldn't have any privilege for that reason either. To say that this bill would virtually eliminate any discovery process on a corporate defendant, as I know Mr. Burt has said, is just incorrect. To say that the bill raises serious constitutional questions is simply incorrect. The Supreme Court has upheld just such a rule for under federal law, and it's applied every day in the U.S. District Court in Oregon, wherever federal law provides the rule of decision. To say that this somehow extends the bill to the privilege to non-attorneys makes no sense. It's only communications by a corporate employee to an attorney or an agent of an attorney, such as a legal assistant, which is going to be protected, and that's the same rule you have now. I guess one way to look at it is as a policy question. In order for attorneys to do their jobs, in order for me to do my job, I need to have full and complete and untrammeled and unlimited access to information from my client. And I need that from my client, whether the person I'm speaking to, the person with the relevant information, is an officer or one step below an officer or somebody below that. It does and it can chill communications if I do my job knowing that someone later, if something goes wrong, can come back and ask that person what I said and so forth. But giving me that protection does not shield in any sense the underlying facts. The assembly line worker can still be asked and would still be asked as to what the assembly line worker saw. Likewise, the boss of the assembly line worker, to whom the assembly line worker is likely to call this problem first, is going to be capable of being deposed, capable of having deposition taken concerning the communication with the assembly line worker. And indeed, the fact of a communication with an attorney and the general subject matter of that communication, although not the specifics, are discoverable, notwithstanding the existence of your attorney-client privilege. We're talking about specific communications from employees to corporate counsel, either in-house or outside. And we're talking simply about putting that on a par with what the individual now enjoys and putting small firms and large firms, this is not a discriminatory bill in that sense, on the same footing.
Suppose the... All right, let me interrupt a moment. Is Connie Osmond here?
No.
Okay, would you go down to visitor service office in the...
In the rotunda in the lobby. There's an emergency phone call where they need you for one reason or another.
Okay. Now, the communication from the employee to the attorney, at least under this bill, we'll say would be privileged. Now, what if the communication is made from the employee to the president of the company?
It's not
privileged. That's not privileged.
Correct.
What if the communication is made to the president of the company who's sitting there with the attorney for the company?
It can be privileged.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, gentlemen.
I guess just, Senator, on your one point, the human resources example that you were discussing before, that would likely come up under federal law. And I haven't noticed any slackening of efforts on the part of federal plaintiffs in discrimination cases or any lack of effort or any lack of drive on account of the federal attorney-client privilege rule, which would be the rule that they would encounter in bringing a federal claim.
Would you happen to have an example you could give the committee arising out of your 11-year practice where a communication was made by one person to the corporate attorney that was held to be not privileged that would be corrected by this bill?
I can't testify to it that way. I can testify to having I have had discussions with clients of mine about whether it was about the problem with trade-offs of going ahead and talking with somebody. And I can say, based on my personal experience, that sometimes I've gone ahead and talked to the employee, and sometimes I haven't. and that when I have done so, sometimes it's affected the nature of my communication with the employee. So in that sense, I can say yes. On the other side, I'm sure it has happened. I can't think of any examples readily.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
I'd just like to respond to that. I have not specifically had that litigation experience, but I have had the same experience in my practice of being reluctant to give, in certain situations, advice to some levels of individuals because they clearly would not be within the control group and on a particular sensitive matter, and somehow have to wait and get the matter to another level within the company before that conversation could occur.
Okay, thank you. We have no other witnesses that are signed up today on this, so I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 726 and go to just these two here. Okay, let's take up Senate Bill 812, followed by Senate Bill 133.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 812 is a bill that's been before us a couple times before. It is a fairly simple bill designed to provide conditions under which an attorney may destroy a will. The primary circumstances under which this can occur are when a will is 30 years old and there is no known address, no way to locate the testator, or when it's been 60 years since the testator died and there's been no known probate. In the 30-year situation, the attorney who holds the will is required to publish notice of his intent to do so. In the 60-year case, no notice is required. The bill also provides that if anyone is damaged by it provides that the will can be proven by other means. So if there's a copy around somewhere and it becomes necessary to prove the will, that can be used. And it provides that anybody who violates the act and who causes damage may be sued for those damages. But it does provide that an attorney who follows the provisions of the act will be immune from an action for damages. There was only one witness on the bill at the hearing. There were no additional comments received at the work session, and there's been no adverse testimony on the bill.
I see this. Well, this is Hannon Gross, dated 4/20,
There are a number of amendments in there, but those were withdrawn because they did not fit the relating clause. They are amendments that deal with a very recent Supreme Court case and were presented because it was thought they might fit into this bill and provide an easy way to deal with that. But Mr. Lundy and Legislative Council and I had a conversation, and as I reported to you at our last work session, we couldn't see that fit in under the relating clause. It was a close question, but I reported that to you, and Senator Cohen, among others, was not willing to have those amendments in. It's my understanding that Diana Godwin has approached the Rules Committee and is working on permission to submit a separate bill to handle those amendments. And the problem was created by that Supreme Court case. The underlying bill itself, as I say, has had no negative testimony, no negative comment of any kind.
All right. Senator Brennan moves Senate Bill 812 to the floor to pass. Discussion? Call the roll.
Senators Brenneman?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Cohen? Hamby?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Wires?
Aye.
Chairman Fry?
Aye.
Okay, 133.
Senate Bill 133 is the bill that deals with the Water Resources Commission that was sent over to us by the Joint Water Policy Committee. You have in your files two additional documents. One is a copy of a letter from Senator Cease, which says May 5th received on it, and has a notation out in the right-hand margin that says new. It has to do with a single word change. And then there is a two-page exhibit from staff, which is the first and second pages of the bill. And then there is the hand-engrossed version of the bill that we presented to you at the last hearing on this, which can be used for pages 3 through 6 of the bill. As I understand it from Senator Cease and from Janet Adkins, who's the administrator in water policy, the amendment that is on the letter dated April 29 and has our received stamp on it of May 5th, which substitutes the verb will for the verb may, has been approved by the Water Resources Department, by Senator Cease, and by the major representatives of the owners of dams. So that, that goes into page 2 at lines 15 through 17. The other major amendment is that the Farm Bureau Federation has proposed simply deleting Section 3. It's my understanding that that's the preference of at least a couple members of the committee, and so the hand-engrossed pages 1 and 2 that have today's date on them reflect that. And then the other changes are shown on pages 3 through 5 of the bill that we handed out last week.
Pages 3 through 5.
And you're dealing with two hand-engrossed versions of the bill. Okay. One has pages 1 through 2, and the other has pages 1 through 5. Right. And I guess what I'm saying is that you need to put today's 1 and 2 together with last week's 3, 4, and 5. I was trying to avoid cutting down more trees.
Well, all right, let's take it from the top then.
I'm going to take these one at a time. Okay, the issue in Section 3, the Water Policy Committee has a couple of amendments, but their basic position is that they ought to be exempt from liability for approval of flood handling plans, inspection of the dam, and measures taken to protect against failure. And their argument is that they have 2.5 people to oversee 3,500 dams. The Farm Bureau Federation's proposal is that the state ought not to be exempt from liability for those things, and simply propose deleting Section 3 so that everything the Water Resources Department does comes under the Tort Claims Act. So that's the first choice you have to make, is whether you want all of the water resources activities to come under the Tort Claims Act, or whether you want to give them some exemption from liability.
All right. Chair moves the deletion of Section 3. Any objection? So ordered, then.
I might say, by the way, there, I don't object. I agree. There's a dam safety fee, inspection fee bill down in the Ways and Means Committee that would allow a lot more inspection, and the bill has been blocked up down there for a couple of months, and so far it doesn't show much sign of moving. So we're going to apparently continue at least for one more biennium unless something changes in the next couple of weeks to not do much inspecting of our dams. Of course, we're sitting comfortably behind our $100,000 tort limit. Okay, somebody, you think that's funny? There are a series of reports of unsafe dams around the state sitting up over populated areas. I don't think it's very funny at all.
Okay, sections on page 2, then if we can all agree, we'll change section 4 to 3, 5 to 4, and 6 to 5. And Chair would move the amendment of section 5 as shown in the hand engrossed two-pager.
Yes.
Subsection 2 of what will become section 5, that is lines 15 and so forth, page 2. Everybody's got that?
No.
It's the two-page hand-engrossed version.
Can you just hold it up? What was it look like? There's a two-page hand-engrossed version that's dated today, May 5th.
Ah.
And if you look on page 2... That goes along with the letter that Senator Cease wrote to me, that you also in your file. Find that letter, Senator Brockman, from Senator Cease. It kind of goes along with the... It looks like... Well, here, hand this down.
I hate to be slowing you down, but I've been going over this, and I... It's all kind of in funny order. I don't have this at all.
Senator Brockman's looking at that. Does anyone else have any comment on it? Yes, counsel?
I guess the only question I have, sometimes legislative counsel finds it easier to simply put a note in that says Section 3 was deleted and subsequent sections were not renumbered. If they did that, would you have any objection?
Oh, I don't care.
Okay.
Just as long as we take care of that when it goes out.
Okay.
Any other questions on that language? Okay. Any questions?
No.
All right, any objection to that? Okay, that's so ordered. Well, I guess we have to go over here to the five-page
hand-engrossed bill with a couple of amendments stuck on the back. The next set of amendments is on page 4. On line 23, insert the word at least, and if you'll remember, we did this for the Department of Environmental Quality in Senate Bill 118 a couple of weeks ago. The language that's in Section 12 parallels the old language that's in the DEQ statute and parallels language in a number of agency statutes. And by inserting the word at least would make it compatible with what we've done for DEQ. Then the change on line 24 is simply what struck me as a clarifying change in language. And then on lines 26 and 33, inserting the word permit brings in an additional document that water policy issues that other agencies don't issue.
Okay. Chair, I'll move the hand and gross amendments as shown to section 12 on page 4. Is there any objection to that? Okay, that's so ordered then.
The change on section 13.
Take the first paragraph first.
The first paragraph is another one that simply inserts the word permit,
okay,
as was done up in section 12.
Right. Any objection to amending it accordingly? All right, that's so ordered. Subsection 2.
And then subsection 2 is a technical amendment proposed by legislative counsel to conform that subsection with other similar statutory language.
Is that what's, is that the Dash 10 amendment?
That's the Dash 10 amendment that's attached to the back of this handout, yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Then the Chair would move the substitution of Dash 10 amendment for
Section 13, subsection 2. Any objection to that? All right, that's so ordered then. And the last one would be on page 5, line 20, right?
That is correct. Purely a technical amendment.
All right. Chair would move those changes as shown there. Any objection to that? Okay, that's so ordered. Let's see, this Senator, are you on the Water Policy Committee or not?
No, I'm not.
Anybody on this committee on that? Okay. Well, we've got it all amended up here now.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brenneman.
I passed out a dash 4, which exempts FERC facilities.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you, Senator.
Oh, I said I passed out the dash 4 amendments last time we held a work session on this. It exempts FERC facilities, dams inspected by FERC. And I'd like to move that amendment.
All right. Senator Brenneman moves the dash 4 amendment. Let me ask a question now. Was this something that was taken up in the Water Policy Committee, do you know?
I can't answer
what's
taken
know?
Up.
Mr. Chairman, you should have in your packets a dash 4 amendment with a handwritten note from Senator Cease on it.
I think
I put that in there that says this was considered.
Yes,
and
that's right. That's
reworded as it came to you in the A. and Gross bill.
That's the one I gave, I lent
yes.
Senator Brockman.
And I found mine in a different packet.
And any discussion on this? I would oppose the amendment because I considered rejecting the Water Policy Committee.
Was Senator Cease's, does she object to them?
Yes, that's my understanding.
I didn't see this.
Yes, do you have a copy of her letter to me?
I apologize.
Also, wouldn't, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Wires.
It sounds like this isn't an amendment that would be within. If this bill was sent to Water Policy to consider water policy issues and up here to consider legal issues, this would sound to me, if they worked on it down there, it sounds to me like this was a water policy issue, not a Judiciary Committee issue. Unless there's something I miss here.
Well, I don't understand, and Senator Brenneman, you're entitled to go ahead and explain, speak for your amendment if you want to.
Well, I think that by having those facilities fall under both federal and state, that it's a duplication cost a factor involved, and that's why I propose.
Any other discussion? Okay, call, let's see. All right, I better call a roll on this amendment then.
Brenneman.
Aye.
Brockman.
Aye.
Cohen.
No.
Hamby.
Aye.
Hill.
No.
Wires.
No.
Fry.
No. That fails.
Okay, move the bill.
All right, Senator Hamby moves Senate Bill 133 as amended to the floor, do pass. Senator Brockman.
No, something very interesting occurs to me. Weren't we supposed to put in some dollar values in these fines that they're imposing on these people? I thought that was the real reason it came here in the first place. Weren't there some civil penalties here, and the reason they sent it to us was to put the right limits on them?
Mr. Chairman.
No, Council.
If you look on page 4 at line 7, and line 9 and line 17, the dollar values are there, and what the committee wanted, the Water Policy Committee wanted this committee to do was simply review the process used and to make sure that this language was consistent with other kinds of statutes that have passed.
That's what that last amendment does, isn't it? Isn't that
yes.
The purpose of that amendment from Legislative Council?
In part, yes. Yeah. But the Water Policy Committee had put the dollar values for the civil penalties in the bill. And then their question to us was, is the process correct?
You want to make any changes, suggest any changes, Matt? Anybody?
Question,
Mr. Yes, Senator Henry.
And the question of retroactive penalties has also then been addressed and is consistent.
Yes, and that is consistent with several other statutes.
Let's see, now what... So the Dash 10 amendment is to conform the procedure then to other statutes?
The Dash 10 amendment deals with the procedure for recording civil penalties with the county clerk in the lien records and providing that it becomes a judgment on the property.
Yeah.
And so that the procedure is identical for water. It makes the procedure identical for water policy that now exists for a variety of other administrative agencies. The original language of the bill would have set up a second procedure, and they figured one procedure for doing that for all agencies.
CSD would be aware that certainly would be respected. You're right, Senator, that unless we were aware of it, we would not have any cause or reason to take any action contrary other than by the proceedings that we're attempting to facilitate the adoption of the child. As Mr. Young has pointed out, and I think you have in my written testimony there too, that CSD was actually not aware that we were in a position that we could not be appointed guardian, and in fact, in those instances where there have been no living parents on the adoption of the CSD children that we're planning on, we have been appointed that guardian. What this does is literally legitimizes some action that might be challengeable if there was ever an appeal made on the proceedings. There is absolutely no impact whatsoever of workload issues. There's not any change in procedures as to the types of children, the types of circumstances that we have been proceeding for a number of years in adoption planning where children do not have living parents. My best estimate is that this involves probably no less than 10 cases a year. We last fiscal year we placed 276 children adoptively, and we'll have approximately that same number this fiscal year.
Well, I wonder why, if the House is so concerned about notice to relatives, why didn't it just say that if CSD proposes to be the guardian, that notice shall be given to all known relatives, siblings, grandparents? I'll find out. You know the answer to that? Or
Mr. Chairman, I do not. I was not present during the House hearings on this bill. Right. They were done by Deborah.
I might say that I believe it was Representative Llewellyn provided some testimony of concern here, and in that due course, that is how this language was put together that you have before you, and the Representative Llewellyn felt that that satisfied the concerns that she had, that it didn't provide any additional power for the Children's Services Division, and that clearly is not the intent of this bill that has been presented from the onset.
That. It just seems to me that that could be a little more, if the intention is to give notice to close relatives who might want to intervene or resist that, then I think it could be more...
Senator Frye.
It could be worded better.
If I may address that particular point, it's interesting that you should bring that up because that, again, as Mr. Stock has mentioned, is that this bill would really only suffice or serve to manage 10 cases thereabouts a year. And that's the point, is that part of the failure to include the notification provision is that it would require monies. And this is my concern, is that this bill in no way requires of CSD to search out known or unknown relatives in the typical estate notification publications that you encounter upon probate. And that should be provided. If anything, it's my feeling that ORS 126233, even though this has been passed by the House, you need to know that it did pass with some question over there, that 126233 needs to be amended to implant these ideas and provisions to suit CSD's needs and to protect the child also.
Okay, thank you. All right, any questions? Senator Brockman.
Is it true what Ms. Ospen said, that you do this routinely anyway, and that really all you're trying to do is to clean up a problem of gender?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brockman, it is a routine practice of CSD to do it anyway. It is not a question of clearing up gender. It's a question of clearing up a technicality in the law. A question could be raised over the authority of CSD to consent or the authority of CSD to be appointed a guardian. Mm-hmm. It is appointed a guardian. The problem might come if somebody chose to move to contest an adoption several years down the road on the grounds that CSD had no authority to either become the guardian or to consent to the adoption. I think we'd probably win that case because it's within the inherent powers of the court, but that could put a adoptive parents through an awful lot of trauma, and what we're trying to do is make sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed.
Senator Brockman, if I may add to that, though, again, is that what this bill fails to do is require of CSD to properly notice all known and unknown relatives. If they gained custody immediately upon the death of the child, for instance, there was a relative back east, and would be second generation removed, that by having the custody of the child in this state, they would not feel it necessary to search out, and that would be difficult, there would be no doubt, but certainly it would be a more appropriate care provider for the child than, and especially if it's under the age of 14, than the state. And I do know of cases where this similar situations have happened, and when relatives have discovered that the child was in custody of the state, that it took up to 2 years and a mighty battle to bring the child back into the family fold rather than having it under the state auspices and possibly adoption implemented. The state does not have a good record of quick adoptions, that's for sure, but we'd want to continue to safeguard that child being adopted out into a strange home. And most importantly, I feel, is placing a child initially in a strange foster setting in the first place.
Okay.
That the relatives are the preferential.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you. We'll put this on for work session then. I'm going to suggest to council to come back with an amendment that in substance as follows. I may be the only one that's concerned about it, but it would say in substance that a notice should be given to the minor's siblings, aunts, uncles, or grandparents if known. Words to that effect. Okay.
Would that require appropriation, Senator Fry? A provision for appropriation?
We're all through with this bill now. Well, yes, Senator Hill.
I don't have the House report. As I recall, it was
59-0.
I'll check that out at the time of work session.
Okay, let's take Senate Bill 358.
Andy.
Where did Eric's gone? Senate Bill 358. Let's see now. Wait a minute.
That's work session.
I don't want to take that yet. I want to go to that yet. I want to take care of. I'll try to get to these two.
Okay.
All right. Let's take House Bill 3071, Mr. Stiles. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is William Stiles. I'm a lawyer practicing in Portland. I live in Washington County. House Bill 3071 is a bill which was introduced by Representative Miller at my request. I happen to have a lawsuit right now that actually will be filed today. It's a coincidence, in which I discovered last autumn that although the Supreme Court had repealed the disciplinary rule which prevented me from being a witness in the case, it happened that the evidence code still prohibited my office from handling the case. My particular situation is one of the ways this can develop, is a situation in which our client was sued, we settled the case, and then we now have a claim against the insurance company for refusing to either defend or to pay. The case, our file, happens to be in now at least three shelves, if not four. It arises out of the volcanic eruption in Mount St. Helens. Would you believe I have a volcano case? But it was filed in Multnomah County. And I know a lot about volcano cases, and I'm a material witness on the reasonableness of the settlement. One of my partners, Rich Spear, is familiar with the case, and we thought, he can try the case. I'm just a witness. I can't be involved in the case other than that. I guess I can help him, but I cannot be an advocate in the case. That's been the normal rule. Our office was disqualified. What happened over a period of years, however, is that I think it's been discovered throughout the country, we started having fights over disqualifying firms. And a firm might be disqualified from handling a case just because one lawyer out of 100. Could be a private office, could be a company in-house counsel situation, or could be a prosecutor's office or a huge government agency finds that one lawyer who happens to join the firm is disqualified because that lawyer is a witness on a material matter. Anything other than innocuous is material. And the whole firm is disqualified, and you have to run out and hire yet a new firm and educate the whole firm over again to all the facts about, in our case, volcanoes, and it could be a lot of other situations. Well, I was amazed when I discovered that the evidence code still prohibited this because the evidence code 606-1, which is based on the disciplinary rule now repealed, provides that a lawyer cannot call another lawyer in the same office on a material matter. So I suggested that the evidence code should be, in that particular regard, that one section should be repealed. The House has agreed and voted 59-0 to repeal it, and the bill is now here. I'm authorized to advise that the State Bar supports the bill. The State Bar Practice and Procedure Committee studied it at some length, and I had some discussions with several members of that committee, and they do support it. And Mr. Olson has so reported in the past to the House. The House committee also asked me to check with Judges Eunice and Robert E. Jones, who have worked very extensively with the evidence code, to find out if they had any objection. And I did, and they both have reported they have no objection. And that's basically the situation. I might mention one other situation that comes up. It can come up in the indemnity situation, which is the one I happen to have, where after one lawsuit is resolved, you have another lawsuit that arises out of the first one. Another situation can arise any time where A sues B, and then a lawyer who happened to be working at one of the offices moves to the other office. The lawyer might not know anything whatsoever about the case, and in fact, it could be a huge law firm, but nevertheless, the whole law firm would be disqualified unless the parties happen to both consent, which sometimes maybe you couldn't even do. That's normally the two situations in which it arises. I moved from one law firm to another in 1972, and actually that came up. In that particular case, it happened that the parties did consent, but we're fortunate that the lawyers knew each other well and could do that. That doesn't happen so much in our society as we get bigger and people know people less and less. That's what I have. I have prepared some testimony giving the details, and I've provided to the committee copies of the old disciplinary rule, which the evidence code was based on, the new disciplinary rule, which repeals the old one in that regard, and a copy of the evidence code, which we ask be repealed.
Okay, now... this thing has apparently been scrutinized by lots of lawyers and lots of judges, and I certainly have respect for the two judges whose names you've mentioned. And now we'll see if our own committee counsel may have some other thoughts on this.
Mr. Stiles, let me ask you about the situation of not the firm member, but the attorney himself or herself. The 606-1 addresses both situations, the attorney individually and the attorney as firm member. The disciplinary rule that was changed, correct me if I'm wrong,
allows the attorney to stay on the case if the firm member maybe calls, but does not materially change the prohibition against the attorney individually from staying on a case if he or she may be called as a witness.
Yes, I think that's right, but I should expand on that to make it a little more clear. I believe technically what it does is it prohibits the lawyer from being an advocate in the case, which I think it literally means getting up and arguing the case to the court or presenting it in any way. I would see, for example, if I were a witness in the case, I would sit outside the bar of the court. And in my practice, 20-some years, I've seen that now about a half a dozen times, where a lawyer, for some reason or another, became a witness in the case and literally moved from inside the bar to outside the bar because it became clear the person was a witness. I think the lawyer can still work on the case. They just cannot be an advocate in the case. Okay.
Let me give you a graphic example, a criminal case situation. Prosecutor is prosecuting a defendant, has a pretrial conference with the defendant, informs the defendant you are to be in court next Monday. The defendant decides to take a vacation, doesn't appear in court. The defendant is then prosecuted for failure to appear on the charge. The prosecutor is the same prosecutor, and the prosecutor wishes to testify. Now, if this evidence rule is deleted, well, under current law, the prosecutor would not be able to testify. If the rule is deleted, the prosecutor would be able to testify. The only thing barring the prosecutor would be a disciplinary rule. And I guess the difficulty I'm having is, what is the trial court's responsibility then when faced with a situation when there's no evidence rule, but there's a potential disciplinary rule violation?
I have heard of situations in which a court has refused to apply a disciplinary rule. I've heard of that, but the only ones I've seen is the courts have enforced the disciplinary rule. You normally see it come up, that I've seen it a few times, is on conflict of interest situations where one lawyer challenges another to handle a matter on the ground that the other lawyer has a conflict, having earlier represented this lawyer's own party. I don't do criminal law work. It seems to me that the prosecutor would be prohibited under the disciplinary rule from testifying, and I think a court has to enforce that. It's part of the law of the land. I think the court has to enforce that just like they have to enforce any other law that exists. It could be disciplinary rule, it could be statutes, it could be case law, it could be federal law. I see a state judge enforcing all of that. I see no excuse for doing otherwise. If the lawyer cannot do it under the disciplinary rules, the lawyer just cannot do it, period.
Your primary concern, however, is the firm member rule. Is that right, as contained within 606-1?
Yes, it happens that it comes up also in the prosecutor situation if this bill is passed by the legislature. I think the situation would be under the fact you pose that the prosecutor who advised the defendant of the hearing date still would not be able to testify on that, because that sounds material to me. But another lawyer in the prosecutor's office could be the advocate handling that case for the prosecutor's office. Under the evidence code as it exists, no lawyer in the prosecutor's office appears could handle that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thanks for being here, Mr. Stiles. Do you live in Senator Hamby's district or somebody else's district?
I
said you live in
Senator
Morrison
Riles'
County.
District.
Senator Riles' district, okay. Well, okay, fine. Nice to have you here anyway. Your office is in Portland. You live what city?
I live in Cedar Hills.
Cedar Hills. Okay. All right, thank you. Let's see. All right, let's take, I was the only witness, I believe, on that bill. Let's take House Bill 2437, Kathy Bogan. Now, wait a minute. Come on up, Kathy, but in the meantime, let me see where we are here. Besides being behind, what do we got left here, Council?
Senator Cohn and I have to leave at 5.
Okay, I was afraid that would be the case.
Yeah, we've got a little subcommittee going on. It matters, I think.
Okay. Are we taking care of all? Are we taking care of all public hearings?
No, they haven't hit that. This one and this one. Put those over to another.
This is your session.
I'm sorry. This is work session.
And the phosphates in the yard.
Yeah. Okay. I think. I think we're just going to end after this bill. So. I haven't missed anybody from out of town, have I? That's the main thing I want to avoid.
We're just going to have to come back. I know that there's a great deal of interest out here on the Senate Bill 358 relating to the juvenile training school. So we'll just have to. But we'll have to have a full committee here anyway on that, basically. So this is where we'll stop for today. Go ahead.
Thank you. Senator Frye, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Bogan. I'm the director of the State Criminal Justice Council. The record should show I'm a state employee and not a hired gun. I'll be very brief before you today. 2437 is a bill that was introduced by Representative Burton that would have made a significant change in corrections policy in the state in terms of making it clear that the state should take over financial responsibility for incarceration of felons. The local governments would be responsible for misdemeanors. Along the way, the bill was substantially amended so that in its present form, it is the amendments dated April 9th. Now it simply says that it's the state's policy that the state be responsible for felonies and local governments for misdemeanors. The council has voted to support that policy, and what I have to present to you today, and I've passed out, are two fairly minor amendments to the bill. The bill now simply directs the governor to study this policy and to bring some report to the next legislative assembly. We wanted to make sure that two specific things were accomplished, and that's what the language of our amendments, which are numbered HB 2437-3, are supposed to achieve these two things. The first, I'll take you through it quickly. The first portion of these amendments, line 2 down to line 7 of the amendments, are technical amendments that Legislative Council has inserted to our amendments. It repeats the language about it being the policy of the state at line 7 of the printed amendments, and I've given Committee Council a marked-up version of those amendments. Our new language begins at line 8 of dash 3 amendments. What we are saying is that the way the bill is presently proposed, nothing would happen in the state in terms of this fiscal responsibility shifting until 1991. If the governor simply brings in a report to the 1989 legislature, then the development of budgets in affected state agencies would not take place until after 1989. What we wanted to see happen is that state agencies be required, we wanted to see this speeded up, that state agencies would be required to develop budget packages for the 1991-93 biennium that would reflect this new policy. I'm a little unsure about how the legislature could go about directing state agencies to do budget packages. This is the language that Legislative Council has proposed. The governor shall submit to the 65th Legislative Assembly a request for such appropriations as the governor determines necessary. On the face of it, it looks a little stronger than what we were proposing, but I think in practice, since it says the governor will request appropriations that he thinks are necessary, if the governor said, for instance, let's not implement this policy at all, let's forget it, and did not require any kind of adjustment in the state agency budgets, I think that would not interfere with his ability to do that. We simply want to see that the next round of budgets that come up here take into account that it is the state's policy that the state pay for felons and the local governments pay for misdemeanors. We're also adding language that says not only the corrections division but all other affected state agencies. There's no telling if this will make a difference to, for instance, the Attorney General, the Parole Board, the Psych Review Board. So we've added in that language. We are adding a new Section 3 to the bill. The governor is, in the present legislation, to delegate to an appropriate task force or agency the responsibility of making this report on implementation of the policy. What we want to have as part of a legislation is the fact that the Criminal Justice Council has a proposal, which is now in Ways and Means, to develop sentencing guidelines, which will be presented to the 89 legislature. As part of those guidelines, we are talking about responsibility for felons and misdemeanors, and we will anyway be making a recommendation about that responsibility. So we've added that language into the bill. It does not interfere with the governor's ability to name another agency to do another task as well. But we wanted to make it clear that that's a part of the work that we're proposing in the sentencing guidelines, and if that bill passes, we would make recommendations as part of that package, which would therefore be part of the discussions in the next legislative session. So.
Questions? Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll close the hearing then.
May I ask Kathy real quick?
Yes, Senator Hammy.
Kathy, I've got a little goldenrod that I've received from my county with a high priority amendment recommendation for the bill that speaks to specific programs such as work release, restitution, community corrections, voc- or treatment programs, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Did any of that discussion take place on the House side at all?
No.
No.
Very little discussion about this took place at all on the House side.
Thank you.
All right. Well, 1 minute after 5, and we'll be adjourned. We'll go over there.